We've got a mailbag, haven't we?
We sure do. And no surprise to anyone who lives in Australia at the moment that a lot of the questions tonight are about COVID, and we'll get to that in a second. But the first one is from Don, who's been advised to take low-dose aspirin because it reduces the risk of developing solid tumours. Don's also seen that aspirin also triggers the production of more stable versions of resolvins, which helps the body to switch off inflammation. But Don has heard that aspirin is either useless or risky unless you've recently had a thrombosis. So sort him out, Norman. What's our current understanding on the benefits and otherwise of aspirin?
Well, low dose, let's start with cancer. Low dose aspirin probably reduces the risk of cancer overall, but it certainly reduces the risk. And we're going to cover this on next week's, to some extent, on next week's health report. If you've got polyps, particularly precancerous polyps on colonoscopy, if you go on low-dose aspirin, it's been shown to actually reduce the recurrence of polyps and therefore downstream reduce the incidence of cancer. So that's a good thing. And it's whether nobody's really sure whether the influence of aspirin on cancer is just because of its effect on bowel cancer, or there is a little bit of evidence about breast cancer as well. A lot of this isn't as hugely researched as it should be. Now, when it comes to preventing heart disease, the use of aspirin, just if you've got risk factors, for example, high blood pressure, diabetes, or high cholesterol, aspirin doesn't work. Aspirin only works when you've had some damage. So in a sense, Don is right. If you've recently had a thrombosis, it's if you've had symptoms or signs of coronary heart disease. So in other words, you've got angina, you've had a stent, you've had a heart attack, and you've had a transient ischemic attack, a TIA, or you've had a stroke. In other words, you've already had the damage. Aspirin can come in and prevent part of the thrombosis. It's been shown, for example, after a heart attack, if you take low-dose aspirin, you can reduce the risk of a second heart attack by up to 20%. So it's a really effective and very cheap drug. That's the kind of current understanding. Natural resolvins, that's beyond my pay scale at the moment. I could come back to you on that one.
And a Dorothy Dixer from me, Norman, because we're about to get into some COVID questions, and we both know from our other podcast, CoronaCast, that lots of people have been asking this. Is there any point in taking aspirin if you're worried about the risk of blood clots from the AstraZeneca vaccine?
The answer is no. Hematologists strongly recommend against that. If you're already on low-dose aspirin for heart disease, for one of the reasons we've just said, stay on it. And the reason that this is a safer situation than somebody starting aspirin, if you're going to get a hemorrhage or problems with aspirin, you tend to get it in the first few months after you start it. It seems to stabilize after that in terms of the risk of bleeding. And so if you start aspirin after the Astra vaccine in the hope that you prevent the clotting syndrome, first of all, it won't prevent the clotting syndrome because it's an immune problem, not a clotting problem. And secondly, what happens with the immune problem with the Astra vaccine, which is very rare, is that the number of platelets in your blood go down. So there's a paradox here. Not only do you get an increased risk of clotting, you get an increased risk of hemorrhage because you need your platelets to actually cause your blood to clot. And so aspirin will further disable your platelets. So it's not a good idea.
And this question comes from Duncan saying, would we know more about our COVID future through numbers of hospitalizations rather than numbers of new cases? Duncan says he knows there's a time lag between those two sets of data, but it seems the limits on us handling COVID are in our hospital capacities, not our number of cases.
Well, what do you think about that, Tegan?
It's an interesting one because I think that there's an ideological difference between the way Australia's handling COVID, where it doesn't want any spread at all, and the way other countries are handling it, where they're keeping it to a number of cases that the hospital system can cope with. So I think it would be a useful thing to know, but I don't know if it's as relevant in Australia as it is overseas.
I agree, except that one thing that Duncan has said there, could we know more about our COVID future? And if you're looking at our COVID future, then we could get to a point where we've got 80, 90% of people vaccinated. As we know, the current vaccines are not 100%, far from 100% actually, preventing infections themselves. So the key question is, if we're very highly vaccinated, that means that we're very highly protected against hospitalizations and deaths. And therefore, it may well be that the metric that's worth looking at as we move forward is it a worry if COVID-19, the virus, comes into the country if nobody comes to any harm? In which case we can start relaxing and, like the flu, allow it in as long as we're covered by immunisation. So in terms of our COVID future, it may well be a pretty good metric.
There's got to come a time where Australia flips to looking at that as a metric rather than just cases, because at some stage we're going to have to open up and we're going to have more COVID then than we've ever had so far, because we've had hardly any so far.
That's right. It's just got to be able to come in and not do any harm.
Exactly. And so Andrew's asking about contact tracing. Andrew keeps hearing about how quote-unquote brilliant New South Wales contact tracers are, and he's also heard that the Victorian contact tracers are not as good, in quotation marks also. Andrew wants to know more about contact tracing. What goes into it? What makes one contact tracing organisation better than another?
Well, I don't think that you can say any longer the Victorian contact tracers are not as good. That's a phenomenon of about a year ago when the second wave occurred and the contact tracing organisation was just not up to it. It's not the individual contact tracers were bad. It's the system in which they worked was not that good. And then you didn't have the public health teams on the ground distributed throughout Victoria. That's all changed. And so I think what you saw in particularly the last outbreak in Victoria, the contact tracers in Victoria are very, very good. There's probably not much difference between daylight between New South Wales and Victoria, or indeed most other states. So they're pretty good. The Northern Territory isn't match fit, so we'll see how that goes. And it's just hard work. It's using sometimes computerized customer relations management systems, so the sort of things that commerce use to actually track customers, know where they are, what they're doing and so on, and tracking them through some established what are called CRM programs or adapted ones. They sometimes use whiteboards to track tracers. It's a lot of phoning and interviewing and spending a lot of time on the phone, finding out where people are, cross-checking it with the QR codes. It's just bloody hard work. And when each contact that they have has 10 further contacts, it's an enormous task which can soon run away from them. But it's systematic, well-controlled, monitored, observed, and indeed with a lot of teamwork. It is about a team, and it's about a system that that supports the hard work of the contact tracers.
So it's another shameless spruik for our CoronaCast podcast. Back in October last year, we interviewed Raina McIntyre from the Kirby Institute, who lifted the lid a little bit on what the ins and outs of contact tracing are. If you're interested in listening to that, you can go back to the 15th of October 2020, which feels like a lifetime ago.
It does. Yesterday feels like a lifetime ago.
One last question for you for tonight from Claire Norman. She says, I'm all for getting the COVID vaccine. I eagerly await mine. However, Claire has a lot of friends who are not getting it because of the infertility risk rumours. Can the vaccines cause infertility?
No, is the short answer to that question. This is like a lot of rumours and misunderstandings. There's like a core of an issue in here that once upon a time may have had some scientific validity. And it's about the idea that there could be cross-reactivity with something in the placenta, cross-reacting with something to do with the antibodies that the vaccine generates. There's zero evidence of that, and there's no evidence that it's affecting fertility at all. And the anti-vax movement has been pushing menstrual problems, and there's really not a lot of good evidence that there are menstrual problems with the vaccines. So the reproductive effect of these vaccines can be assumed to be virtually zero.
The thing that I'm really taking comfort in from the luxury of Australia is that literally tens of millions of people globally have received these vaccines now that are getting rolled out in Australia. So when they say that there's not enough, like when people are trying to say that there's not much evidence for or against them, it's just plainly wrong. There is so much evidence and they're being watched so closely. We're really, really lucky to be where we are when we are.
Yeah. And in terms of infertility, if you're going through IVF and you're going through you're trying very hard to get pregnant, and it's hard to predict sometimes when you do fall pregnant, is that in fact there's a vaccine imperative. You do not want to get COVID-19 if you're pregnant, and you can do badly and the baby can do badly. So it's something you really want to get covered for.
Well, that's everything in the mailbag for tonight. But listeners, if you want to ask a question, email us, healthreport@abc.net.au.
And we'll see you next week.
See you then.